Podcast European Horror Podcast with your co-hosts Vicky Ray, Will Millar, and Keith Chalgo, exploring the genre from a unique perspective, from extreme to classic, in a world that is set to chill you to the bone.
Hello, welcome to Literary License Podcast, and it's our European Horror, and it's the last European Horror that we are now doing, because this is coming to the end of Season 3, and the film we're doing today is Black Sabbath, the 1963 film from Italy. And before we get started, let's find out who's with us. Today we have Joe Randazzo. Hello, Joe. How are you?
Hi, Keith. Great to be back. How are you guys?
I'm doing groovy. And how about you? We also have Rob Labby. Labby. Hello, Rod. How are you?
It is Labby. At last, Labby. You pronounce it correctly. It's Labby, not Labby. 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 I'm doing good. I'm in quarantine, semi.
Why?
But I'm doing good up here in Maine. It's very hot and what they call muggy, what the locals call muggy. Humid. And I can do without the humidity.
But you're not sick, are you?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
No. I'm perfectly fine. It's just humid, you know, sticky, okay. Wet. Let's not even go there, okay?
Okay. I just hate it when it gets sticky.
Yeah, it's so sticky.
Sticky. Yeah, it's quite funny because I interviewed Deborah Foreman earlier this week later on in the podcast, and she did this film called My Chauffeur, and basically she's walking through this desert with this person. It's one of those 80s B movies, and one of her lines, it says sticky. I just hate it when it gets sticky, don't you? She just goes on for like 10 minutes about how sticky it is, to the annoyance of Tab Hunter, who's with her. That's quite funny.
At least she didn't use the word moist.
Moist. And we also have Vicky Ray. Hello, Vicky. How are you?
Hi, guys.
And
it is 105 almost down here.
That's oh God!
Index. You want to talk sticky and moist, Rod?
Yeah. You don't have. That's not dry heat. It's not a dry heat.
Whoever tells you that sits on a throne of lies. I don't know where that comes from. Dry heat. What the fuck?
Yeah,
is
I've
that?
Heard that. Arizona too. Arizona has dry heat.
Well, they
that
might have a dry heat, but Northeast Texas does not have dry heat.
Oh, that must be awful. Horrible.
I'm not going out today. Not today.
Well, before we get started, let's find out what we've each been up to. So, Rod, what have you been up to since last time we spoke to you?
Well, I finished a short story that I sent off to
awesome.
Scary Monsters magazine. And this was, I don't usually write short fiction, but I did write this. I was inspired. And it's about essentially an Avon. Does anybody remember Avon? You know, Avon Calling, when they actually had women that went around to the neighborhoods?
Yes.
That's a thing of the past, but they used to do that. Remember, they had an Avon lady. Well, this is about an Avon lady who's kind of loony, and she slashes her customers to death and because they're failed makeovers. And I submitted that, and I guess that will be, you know, I had to cut down one thing of profanity where somebody's looking at a bottle and a bottle of after bath splash, and it's shaped like a hen. And she says, the customer asks, is that the shape of a pecker? And the woman in the story was very shocked by the sailor talk. But the name of the perfume was The Sky is Falling, and it was a little in the decanter shape like a hen, like Chicken Little. And I had to make an adjustment for this family-friendly magazine. I had to cut that out, which was terrible. I didn't like doing that. So I did that, and I just finished up a big article that was like 27 pages in length for, again, Scary Monsters, who's doing a tribute to a magazine called Castle of Frankenstein from the 60s and 70s.
Awesome.
That'll be in the spring. And that's it's called Hammer Goes Hollywood, and it's about when Hammer Studios actually utilized Hollywood talent like Betty Davis and Tallulah Bankhead and Joan Fontaine and people like that in their productions. Quite a bit different than the other stuff that was going on around the time, although Vincent Price was considered a movie star. And so was Ray Milland, who was in AIP, and Jack Palance did Amicus stuff, and he was he was poised for a comeback. He came back when he was an elderly man. But I did that, and that was I'm meticulous when it comes to editing, and that's been the thing that's been holding me up. But I will finish it today.
I can't wait to read that. I love Hammer Films. I love Amicus Films.
I can't wait to read that either. Keep us posted on that one.
Yeah, I should mention 1 Million Years BC, and it would Raquel Welch. I covered that. And She with Ursula Andress. That's another Hammer film. And those movies, they were movie stars. They were big stars for the time.
Oh, yes, they were.
Yeah, and with Raquel, you know, she went on to have a big Hollywood career. But the movie she's most remembered for is 1 Million Years BC.
Bikini, wasn't it?
The furry bikini. Bikini.
Yeah.
That was in Shawshank Redemption. It played a big part in that movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That?
Yes, that's right.
Didn't she do like Myra Breckinridge after that?
She did.
Yeah, she did that. That's probably your second most famous film.
Yeah.
So outrageous and so 60s. You know, I saw it. Mae West was interviewing studs, and one of the studs was Tom Selleck before he was Tom Selleck.
Right.
It's kind of funny. Yeah, she said he said something about she said, "How tall are you?" And he said, 6'7". She said, "Never mind the 6 feet. Let's go talk about the 7. It was dialogue like that. Oh, my God. It was so funny.
I love
Myra Breckinridge. She looked like a walking corpse, but she looked good.
Well, did you also cover Die, Die, My Darling then?
Yes, Tallulah Bankhead. That's a very good film,
Stephanie Powers.
Stephanie Powers. And Tallulah was very convincing, you know, as a nutty, religious, crazy woman who wanted to sacrifice her pseudo sister, daughter-in-law. And Stephanie Powers was very, very good in that part. Very realistic, and it never got the
recognition,
the kudos it deserves.
No, it doesn't.
It never did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
I actually bought a copy of it, so I have a copy that I bring out every couple of years.
Oh, you have a copy
good.
Of everything.
It's good from beginning to end.
And I also liked The Devil's Own, but also known as The Witches in the UK, with Joan Fontaine, where she's a teacher and uncovers witchcraft in a small English village. I really enjoyed. I like her as an actress anyway, and I really enjoyed that movie. A lot of people don't like it, though, but I did like it.
I'm more forgiving of these Hammer films.
Yeah, I'm more forgiving of these movies that don't have the technology that we know now. Like Black Sabbath, for example.
That's what makes them so good, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you... the thing that got me... Well, we'll be talking about that. I'll save it for when we talk about, actually, Black Sabbath. But that was a great film. I had never seen Black Sunday until a few months ago, and I thought that was really a weird film. Scary, too.
Oh, I love Black Sunday.
Another great one.
Barbara Steele. Sex on a stick, that woman.
Oh, Barbara Steele. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the scene where she comes to life after she's been, you know, whatever, is very frightening. Very, very well done. Black and white, atmospheric, death coaches and things like that. It's scary. Yeah.
That's a very good film. So, Joe, what have you been up to since last time we spoke to you?
I'm about 70 pages into one screenplay, 30 pages or so into a slasher screenplay. I've been helping to produce Hex and Arcane, a horror host show out of Wisconsin. The two women that you see on camera, they do the majority of the work. They are super independent. They do everything on their own. And actually, by the time this posts, we'll be able to announce it anyway. So I'll announce it here. Starting September 1st, we're on TV in Chicago on Channel 19 Can TV. We'll be on Tuesdays at 10 p.m. And for right now, we have some episodes up on Amazon Prime, but I don't know when those are up. They put those up when they feel like it. And you can catch all the episodes that have been shot so far on Vimeo.com/Hex and Arcane. two horror hosts, two beautiful women that are showing both classic public domain movies, and they're also bringing out new films by new filmmakers whose films haven't really been seen all that much. So definitely check us out. If you're in Chicago, you'll be able to check us out on TV.
Well, hopefully you'll be nominated for a Rondo Award. That would be
maybe
something.
We hope
that would
so.
Be excellent.
Are you familiar with Dinosaur Dracula? Does that ring a bell?
I don't know.
Dinosaur Dracula.
Uh-uh.
Oh.
It's some guy that does this on YouTube. It's quite good. It's weird, interesting. But I wish I lived in Chicago so I could watch your TV show.
You can check it out on Vimeo. I'll send Keith all the links because we've been
okay.
They have been very gung ho about shooting every single week. Like they don't take a week off.
Good.
So, wow. Good.
I like them.
That's dedication.
I think this is going to be our 15th or 16th episode posting this weekend.
Ooh, excellent.
Already. And we just started in April.
I am way behind.
Haunted Hill is public domain, correct?
What is?
House on Haunted Hill.
It is. Yeah.
The original of Vincent Price.
It is.
I believe that's public
domain. At some
point,
I'm assuming we're going to do it. I watched
some public domain films on Amazon I watched the other day. I watched The Dangerous Game, which is public domain now. You know, where you hunt humans.
Movie. With Joel McRae?
Yep. And the other one, The Old Dark House with Gloria Stewart.
I saw both of those at a movie palace in New Jersey about 10 years ago. They had done this giant retrospective and they showed both of those movies at different times. Old Dark House played with Edgar Ulmer's The Black Cat, and The Most Dangerous Game played on a double bill with Island of Lost Souls.
Wow, I'm impressed you know these things. How old are you, anyway?
39.
I am impressed that you... Jack Benny's age. I'm 29 myself, but anyway.
How many years have you been 29, Rod?
A long time. A long time, yes, a long time.
I've been a movie nerd since high school, so I seek out everything. So,
wasn't The Old Dark House considered a lost film at one point?
Yeah, it was. Curtis Harrington apparently made it his life mission to find a copy of it, and eventually in the 80s he managed to find like a really muddy print of it.
You know, I always thought that his life's mission was directing Shelley Winters and What's the Matter with Helen, but I guess I was wrong.
Well, I guess this was
Who Flew Auntie Roo.
Yeah, that's another one. Yes,
or
that's
a
one
really
of the funniest
underrated
scenes I've ever seen,
or a really underrated film by him, Devil Dog, The Hound of Hell.
Yeah,
oh, I've never thought that was TV though, right?
That was a made-for-TV movie.
It?
Yeah, really. Like, you'd think it would be such a stupid movie, and then when you watch it, it's so well executed. It completely, like, obliterates what the premise should have been. It goes so above and beyond what you think that movie should be and how bad it would be under less capable hands.
He also did Queen of Blood, which is a pretty good movie, I think, with John Saxon, who just passed away.
Basil Rathbone, I believe, is in that, too.
Yeah, Basil Rathbone walks through that. Yes, he is. As long as he's ambulatory and can speak with a cue card, he's there.
Yeah, he wasn't
really
pretty ill.
Movie, though.
It is a pretty solid movie.
Yeah, it is a solid movie. But I really liked What's the Matter with Helen. I went to the movies to see that when that came out, and it did not disappoint me. And the ending is great. I don't know if you remember the ending, but the ending is great.
Yeah.
With an unhinged Shelley Winters playing the piano, and nobody does unhinged like Shelley Winters. Yeah, Shelley Winters. When I mention her name now, everybody says, oh, the Poseidon Lady.
That's right.
Poseidon Adventure. But she was known for so much more than that.
Yes. She was an excellent actress.
She is an excellent actress. Night of the Hunter was a great film. One of my favorites, in fact.
That's one of my favorites as well. I think I got when DVDs are first coming out, I think MGM did Midnight at the Drive-In DVDs, and they had
Midnight Movies.
Yeah. And Ed, I got what's the matter with Helen and who slew Auntie Rue?
Yep, I have that too. That's the Midnight Movies line. And that that movie, Who Slew Auntie Rue, had one of the funniest scenes I've ever seen in it, which was played for drama, where a little girl is sliding down the banister of a staircase and she falls off. And Shelley Winters screams in her patented shrieks. I laughed my ass off. I don't know why I thought that was so funny, but it was supposed to be a tragic moment. I didn't find it very tragic, however. People like Shelley.
When I was living in Tulsa, when I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, when I was going to uni there, I lived in an apartment complex called the Ambassador, which was like an old 1920s.
Oh, I love those hotel. Old hotels. Love them things.
So I had a flat there, and Shelley Winters was used to go there. She was dating one of the guys there, one of the old men's there. This is about 87. It's between 1983 and 85. And she used to come in through the great big lobby and say hi to everyone, because we used to be sitting there, just sitting in the lobby, normally off our face, and she'd say hi to us and we say hi back to her. She was quite
wow.
She's really friendly. So I mean,
well,
before I really
actress.
Got into movies sort of thing, you know, I kind of knew movies, but I kind of got into them, you know, with the invention of, you know, video players, you know, VHS and Beta. That's when I started really getting into film. So I kind of wish I was kind of into that now. I mean, God, I could like, you know, seen her. But for me, I mean, the only thing I knew her from was Poseidon Adventure. And the, what's the one where she did with Robert De Niro? That's a Roger Corman film. And she's Big Bad Mama.
Oh, Bloody Mama. Was it Bloody Mama or Boxcar Bertha?
I think it was Bloody Mama.
Yeah, it was Bloody Mama.
Boxcar Bertha had Barbara Hershey in it.
She also played the girlfriend that got killed and he was in love with, Elizabeth Taylor. What? Something.
Place in the Sun.
Because that happened up in the Adirondack, so everybody was interested in that story.
Well, there had been a movie made of that before called An American Tragedy.
Yes.
So that was a remake. But Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor, you can't beat that, that's for sure.
No.
So.
Was that
before or after his car wreck? Was it the old face Montgomery Clift or the new face?
I think that was...
It was the before.
The old face.
Before. Just like, remember him in The Heiress with Olivia de Havilland, who just passed away? And he was a handsome ne'er-do-well, which is how he looked in that movie as well. And in From Here to Eternity, before his accident. He really never recovered from that accident. There's something about his face. I don't know what the heck happened to it.
I
know
didn't
it went
really
through the windshield.
Think it was that bad. I know Elizabeth Taylor always was very protective of him and kept him under her wing to some extent.
Well, he was gay.
Yeah, she
was
did.
Doing that with all the gays.
I wasn't going to say it.
Yeah, she did that with Rock Hudson, too.
Yeah,
so,
she did.
I mean, she was very and Roddy McDowell, let's not forget him.
Yeah.
So he was in the mix as well.
Right.
Although I love Roddy McDowell, I miss Roddy McDowell. He was a great actor.
Yes, he was.
You always knew it was going to be entertaining if he was in that Night Gallery pilot.
Oh, God, I love
that. I don't know
that.
If you remember that. That
the one with
the
pictures.
Best things I've ever seen on TV. Oh yes, that was great. That was great. He was great in it. Falls down.
And wasn't it Steven Spielberg's first directing role as well? Wasn't he?
The
Joan Crawford one.
The Joan Crawford one, and I thought that was quite good too. Ironic, you know.
In the eyes of Tom Bosley.
Yes. she had thicker eyebrows than Tom Bosley did, but I thought that was interesting. She did. I mean, they showed the two eyes, two pairs of eyes melding together as the brain, as the corneas get transplanted or whatever the hell she was doing. And supposedly the blackout in New York was so black that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. I doubt it would be that dark.
I don't know. I think if I got an eye transplant, and that probably would happen to me. It's like, great, blackout. Got my new eyes. Can't even use them.
That was
like it's been like waiting all day and saving up for something. You bring it home and you realize that you don't have the batteries. It's kind of like that, isn't it?
So. Oh, yeah. Or it's broken, or there's something else in the package that you didn't expect.
Yeah.
The thing is, what I liked about that episode about the eyes was that she wanted to see color.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to explain to a person who's always been blind what color is.
Oh, God,
I mean, you can kind of explain it as far as temperature. Like, you can say cold is blue. You know, green smells like this, and you put like a a Christmas tree under their nose or something. Red is hot and yellow is hot, is warm, but
and what does
there's
brown
not much
smell
to go
like?
On with that. Shit, unfortunately. Avoid brown. Tell them to avoid brown. Don't step in it. Even though you can't see, whatever you do, don't step in it. So anyway, I like Joan Crawford too. I liked all those old horror hags, how they went from being strong leading ladies in the 40s and were really pioneers of their day to becoming victims and mentally deranged axe murderesses when they got older. I loved it.
They did a great job at it.
Yeah, they did. I mean, Joan Crawford in Straight Jacket, when she chops those guys up, how can you ask an Oscar winner, okay, take this axe and chop the head off the dummy? I mean, that takes a lot of gumption to tell to direct a woman and tell her to do that when she's got an Oscar sitting on a shelf, you know?
Well, they did jump through hoops with her. I was reading on this William Castle book that he wrote about the making of that. And then basically, because of her... You know, it's before Faceless, really. And what they had to do is they had to have below freezing whenever they shot with her, so that way her face would be frozen to keep make sure the wrinkles didn't show.
I didn't know that.
Oh. Yeah, it's quite funny.
Did you?
So, Vicky, what have you been up to since last time we spoke to you?
Not much. Just getting Asher ready for the States and stuff like that, and talking to you guys. And my life is not as full as Rod's this week, clearly, but we're working on it now. We're just trying to deal with the heat, do a lot of reading, catching up on a lot of my slasher stuff, because that's what I like doing, and trying to follow all the activities of everybody on this show, because y'all are busy. You know, we've got good shit going on, and I have to give a big heads up to that Hex and Arcane, because that is really awesome. Now that I know where to find all the episodes, I can start binging. Because
yeah, I'll send the direct link to you in a message awesome. As soon as we're off the air here.
Yeah, definitely. If y'all looking for something to watch that's different and it's funny and they really love what they do, you should watch Hex and Arcane for sure.
Thank you. They're going to love you.
And myself, basically, we've had the middle of a heat wave. So basically, I've been out in the garden every day reading to Monte Cristo. Fantastic book. We're going to be springboarding our season 4 Book the Screen episodes with. I kind of wish I did a bit more research on it, because it was 1,300 pages. And
required reading in high school, okay? Don't you remember high school?
We didn't read that one. I think we read The Hobbit instead or something.
That was close to like 1,000 pages.
But I have to sit there and say it was, we'll go into more detail in a couple of weeks when we cover it. But I mean, I feel like I ran a marathon and I felt like I got some kind of reward out of it. So it was worth it.
It's a good book.
For being out in the sun while you're sitting there, sweating away, and I got a nice color out of it. So yeah, that's pretty much all I've done was read that, because once I realized how big it was, I was kind of panicking that I would have it done in time. So that's about all I've done. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut to Story Geek. And Story Geek is going to tell you what you can watch and what you can download through the COVID-19 crisis and what films are available this week. So take it away, Story Geek.
What movies and TV shows should you be watching the week of August 10th? I'm Jay Shear, executive producer of the Story Geeks podcast, and here are the movies and TV shows you can watch from home. Nothing new in wide release movies available for rent. We're still waiting for Mulan. So we'll jump straight into streaming. August 1st, we got a bunch of new content. I'll give you some recommendations from that. But there are some new movies available since then as well. We'll take a look at those. Over on Netflix, Nightcrawler has been added, the thriller starring Jake Gyllenhaal as a freelance photographer paparazzi. It looks really disturbing, but it has great reviews. Metacritic gives it a 76. I mentioned this in last week's segment, but I also thoroughly enjoyed Umbrella Academy Season 2. I thought it was outstanding, and it may put Umbrella Academy in my top 10 TV shows of all time. If you like quirky comic book mayhem, this is a fantastic show. Definitely watch Umbrella Academy. Season 1 and Season 2 are both fantastic. Also, a throwback recommendation from me. I rewatched The Naked Gun. That movie is hilarious. If you haven't seen that in a while, definitely check that out over on Netflix. Over on Amazon Prime, they've added The Peanut Butter Falcon. A young man with Down syndrome runs away from a nursing home to try and train to be a professional wrestler. Along the way, he meets a small-time outlaw who attempts to help him on his quest. Shia LaBeouf plays the small-time outlaw. Metacritic gives The Peanut Butter Falcon a very respectable 70. The King of Staten Island is also available on Amazon Prime. It's a comedy starring SNL's Pete Davidson, comedy icon Bill Burr, and Marissa Tomei. Metacritic gives The King of Staten Island a 67. My two personal recommendations for Amazon Prime are Inception, a Christopher Nolan film that explores planting ideas in people's heads and invading their dreams. On the Story Geeks podcast, we got to interview Dilip Rao, who plays Yusef in Inception. Super insightful guy. Really fun interview. Inception is a complex, fascinating, and action-packed film. I think you'll really enjoy it. My other recommendation on Amazon Prime is 310 to Yuma. In classic Western style, 310 to Yuma pits Christian Bale against Russell Crowe. It's a classic Western done in a modern style, and I think it's great. Disney Plus has added the original X-Men film. They've been adding a lot of the X-Men films over there. The original X-Men film is really still fun after all these years. It has a 64 on Metacritic. They've also added the Peanuts movie, which is based on the comics characters. Metacritic gives that film a 67, which is a great score, and I might have to check that out. Also on Disney Plus, they've added Howard, a documentary about Howard Ashman, who wrote the lyrics for classic films like Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid, and Little Shop of Horrors. Metacritic gives that documentary a 76. One last mention, I did watch some of Beyoncé's Black is King on Disney Plus, and while it is visually stunning and some of the music is really, truly good, I will say that it feels pretty out of place to me on Disney Plus and seems far better suited for like YouTube, probably. I know it's related to The Lion King, but realistically that relationship is pretty minor in terms of when you watch that film, and the relationship between The Lion King and Black is King seems kind of, it's not a strong relationship, let's put it that way. Metacritic did give Black is King an 84 though, which is a fantastic score, so I'd love to hear what others think about Black is King. Finally on Hulu, Monsters Ball was added, which I mainly recommend because I found the difference between the critic score and the audience score to be really striking. This is a Halle Berry, Billy Bob Thornton film. The critics give Monsters Ball a 69, but the audience only gave it a 3.9 out of 10. Ouch. That's not good. So I don't know what you guys think of Monsters Ball, but it's over on Hulu now. You can watch it there. But again, my recommendations for the week are Umbrella Academy Season 2. Season 1 and Season 2 are fantastic. If you like comic book mayhem, definitely watch the Umbrella Academy. I also recommend The Naked Gun over on Netflix. Super funny movie, a little bit of a throwback into the early 90s or late 80s, early 90s. That series goes from the late 80s to the early 90s. Only the first one is available on Netflix. The second one is available for rent on Amazon Prime. Naked Gun 33 and a third, which is the third film, is available on Amazon Prime for free. And then again, on Amazon Prime, I recommend 310 to Yuma and Inception. Naked Gun 33 and a third is nowhere near as funny as Naked Gun, but if you still have time, it's free. You can watch it on Amazon Prime if you choose to. On the Story Geeks podcast, we're in the middle of our independent video game series over the summer. Check out our just released show on the horror indie game Inside. You can find the Story Geeks podcast on your preferred podcast provider. Until next week, this has been Jay Shear from the Story Geeks podcast, and I hope you have fun streaming movies and TV shows from home.
Welcome back to Lit Your License Podcast, and thank you, Story Geek, for all those wonderful suggestions. And I'll be watching most everything that you have, and if I'm not, I'll probably be going to a pirate station if they're not available here in the UK. But anyway, this is the Lit Your License Podcast, and our film that we're covering today is Black Sabbath, which is a 1963 horror anthology film directed by Mario Bava. The film is centered on three separate tales that are introduced by Boris Karloff. The first, entitled The Telephone, involves Rosie, who continuously receives threatening telephone calls from an unseen stalker. The second is the Rudlock, where a man called Gorka returns to his family after claiming to have slain a once loved. The third story is The Drop of Water, is centered on Helen Corey, is a nurse who steals a ring from a corpse that is being prepared for burial and finds herself haunted by the ring's original owner after arriving home. This was a low-budget horror film with multiple stories, very much like the Amicus would later do these in the late 60s, early 70s. I think one thing that Mario Bava pretty much does, that you'll see that these are three separate stories. There's nothing actually intertwining them, where Amicus would actually do the anthology films and have like some kind of intertwining thread that would go in between them to connect these. The film was a commercial failure upon its release in Italy and performed below expectations in America due to America's heavy cutting of the lesbian scene and changing the telephone from lesbianism and changing it to a supernatural effect, getting rid of the lesbianism and prostitution because they didn't want to offend puritanical America.
Oh, God, no. Let's not offend America.
The Black Sabbath was supposed to have another film done by Mario Bava, which was supposed to be a spiritual sequel to the film based on the Dulwich Horror, and previously titled Scarlet Friday, was set to reunite Bava with Boris Karloff and co-starring Christopher Lee, but AOP distanced themselves from Bava following the failure of Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs, and eventually produced the film without Boris Karloff or Lee's involvement. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut to the trailer for Black Sabbath, and we'll be back after the trailer.
Do you believe in ghosts?
This is the night when fear and horror walk hand in hand.
This is Black Sabbath.
Starring the incomparable Boris Karloff, the personable Mark Damon, and lush and lovely women. Even though one is from the netherworld, a vampire, a Vordalak. Black Sabbath, as ancient as superstition, as modern as the telephone.
How nice you look with that towel around you. You always did have a beautiful body. Beautiful. A body to drive someone crazy.
Who are you? Who?
Black Sabbath, the bare truth about the unbelievable, such as the brilliant beauty of a priceless jewel that holds within the body of a buzzing fly, a vengeful woman's murderous spirit. Only on the seventh night of the seventh full moon can the living see the lifeless undead.
I am hungry.
Is he man or vampire? An adventure into black magic that goes beyond the boundaries of the supernatural. And a man's devoted love is welcomed by a woman's deadly lust for his blood.
Fascinating.
Oh, welcome back to the Literary License Podcast. And this is, we're talking about Black Sabbath, a 1963 horror anthology film from Italy. So, Joe, what are your thoughts of Black Sabbath? That's probably the best thing to do is actually, you know, cut back. Let's go to each story, let's cover each story, and then we'll do an overflow.
Idea.
So, let's start off with, what do you think of Black Sabbath? The telephone.
Black Sabbath in general and Mario Bava overall. I posted something on Facebook yesterday saying that I think Mario Bava is the most influential horror filmmaker in history. And I think that this film, I took so many notes down on so many things that I saw pop up in other movies since. And The Telephone, I feel like without The Telephone, we don't have the giallo genre. We don't have the slasher genre.
Agreed.
You know, I'll pull up my notes right now as I got it in my notepad on my phone. When a stranger calls,
yeah.
There's a, the way Bava photographed everything, I mean, his days as a cinematographer just are evident in everything. The way he immediately you can see that how this film went on to influence Creepshow. That's right from Boris Karloff's initial introduction. The color schemes and all that stuff. Later, you can see Romero was influenced by it. Second note I made was nobody photographs women the way Bava does. Michelle Mercier in that opening scene where she comes back out in the bathrobe looks so incredibly sexy. Everything about the way she's shot, everything about the way she's lit, it's phenomenal. The man was an artist. He was a painter with a film camera. And you'll see it more in the Verdelak story and the Drop of Water. But this is in a way a proto slasher. We're seeing everything through the eyes of the voyeur. You focus on the one room because they give you this idea that whoever it is actually watching her, even though it's 1963 and it's impossible that anybody would be able to call her while watching her like that. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal storytelling, phenomenally suspenseful. It's everything that became of the genre later on. And I can't stop gushing about it. I'm going to stop because everybody else, I'm sure, has things they want to say about it.
What about yourself, Rob? What do you think of The Telephone?
Well, when I saw this movie originally, and not to date myself, of course, I always do this, but I saw this originally at the movie theater, okay, which was probably in 1964, which would make me 11. And my sister worked for a movie theater, so she'd get me these free passes, and it seemed like there was always an AIP film there at every weekend. And I really liked it. I'm going by the American version right now because I don't have the Italian version. I watched the American version. I thought that the Telephone worked best as the middle film because it's not the strongest of the three. Definitely, the Drop of Water, which is a masterpiece, in my opinion, and The Verdelak, which is also very, very good and influenced Stephen King in the sense that we'll talk about that when we get to that. But I agree with Joe about the slasher genre, which didn't even exist back then, really seems to have its origins in Halloween and Friday the 13th and those films of the late 70s and very early 80s. So this is something like 15 years ahead of its time. She was photographed very lovingly, and she was very beautiful. I was put off by the name Rosie, which didn't strike me as something that you'd hear in Italy. It just struck me as too Americanized. Rosie was the name of the Janet Leigh character in Bye Bye Birdie, and that's who I always think of when I hear that name, Rosie. I thought it was very well done. I thought the ending was good, and it was scary, but it wasn't strong for me. And as far as the lighting is concerned, Mario Bava painted with light. I mean, he obviously did, which you see in Planet of the Vampires and things like that he directed. And you also see in A Drop of Water, especially. And I really enjoyed it, but I didn't enjoy it as much as the two others. And I think it works better as the middle rather than the beginning.
So the interesting thing then is that you saw a completely different film than we did, because in our version, Rosie, this whole thing is a ploy by Mary to get Rosie alone, so that because they were their former lovers. In the American version,
that's gone.
The letter is completely different. The letter that's written by Mary is completely different. In ours, she admits that she did this to get Rosie close to her again, because Rosie, when she broke it off, swore she'll never see her again. In the American version, they imply that Frank is a ghost and that he's dead. In the Italian version, he's an escaped convict who Rosie helped put in prison. So they're two entirely different films.
They are exactly. Mm-hmm. I still can't figure out, you know, it's like, okay, so he's calling her. Is he, this is the part where you guys always give me my introspect in. He's not in the house, and clearly he doesn't have a cell phone. Somebody's looking in through the blinds. I think that was in both versions. I watched both because it didn't in the Italian version, you can see where the American version doesn't quite make as much sense unless you watch the subtitled Italian version. And where he's, I guess he's her pimp, I believe. Is that what it is?
Well, yeah. He was her pimp in the Italian version.
And she had
the American one is a boyfriend.
You can't figure out. He seems like a mobster / boyfriend kind of thing that she, you know, pissed off in the American version. But I was just trying to figure out, well, they kind of made it look, you kind of wondered if it was supernatural in both versions, though, because is he in the house? Or who's watching outside with the blinds? You know, and I mean, I loved it. I mean, I thought it was suspenseful. You wanted to see what was going on. He knew when she hid her money. You know, he knew, you know.
Well, see, first of all, it wasn't Frank making the phone calls anyway.
Okay, that's right. It was her. Is that the American? That was the Italian version.
In the Italian version, it's Mary. Right. In the English version, it's the ghost of Frank.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I digress.
So when you look at the Italian version, I guess that basically, so when you see someone coming, looking in, it could be Frank looking in, or it could just be a random person. It's kind of like, you know.
Well, she is on the bottom floor, so, I mean, a cellar apartment.
But the thing is, it could be Frank. I mean, as we know that in the Italian version, that Frank does mean to wreak his revenge and ends up going after Mary instead of Rosie.
And I did notice they didn't have the older gentleman with the dog in the other version. Mm. Am I correct?
No, that was only in the American version.
Okay, because I did not remember seeing him. I know she heard noises outside. And in the American version, she goes outside and the older gent has his dog and he's walking the dog and he talks to her and gives her a brief. So those were shot particularly just for the American audience because they knew they weren't going to buy into, you know, well, Europe, let's face it. They don't care about sex and everything else. Like, we are violent as hell over here. So I guess it's a trade off for our cultures. Sex for the violence.
One other thing.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, this film was done originally for Italy and those markets. Was it then purchased by AIP? Is that, or did AIP have something to do with it originally being produced in Italy?
AIP co-produced it and actually sent a representative over to Italy to shoot alternate takes and alternate scenes for the American cut. So it was purposely done so that they would have the footage. And actually,
that's why Mark Damon appears in it as well, because he's AIP and Karloff. They're AIP loan notes. So
there's one other thing that I had noticed, and it's I grew up speaking Italian, so I noticed that there was something mistranslated, and I don't know if it was intentional, that they just left out a couple of words which change everything. When Mary takes the phone off the hook and leaves it off the hook in the Italian version, what she actually says is, "We'll go to the police tomorrow." Whereas the translation is indicating that it's so Frank can't keep calling. So this is entirely a ruse. I'm going to stay overnight with you and they're not going to bother us. This is entirely a ruse to sleep with Rosie. And it's completely revealed at that point, at least in the Italian language it is. In the translation, not as much.
I mean, what I quite like about the telephone is that, which basically is kind of, and this is what I quite like about Mario Bava, is like you get Les Baxter's jazz music playing, and then all of a sudden you get these uncomfortable silences that, and I have to sit there and say that he does something that horror films don't normally do, is that when something horrible normally happens, that's when the music comes in. But he does the opposite here. What you basically have is when nothing's really going on, you have the music, and then when something horrible happens, the music stops. So he does it in complete reverse, which I have to sit there and say that it's quite an interesting way to doing it. And the telephone, it works very, very well. And it does work, you know, when we get to the others, it actually works really well. It works even better later on. But what I quite like about the telephone, for me, I've seen the American and the Italian, and for the Italian version, having the telephone started out, it actually works out quite well, because then what you do is then eventually you start going into, you know, you have something that's set in real life. This is a real life situation. This can happen to you. This is realism. And you have this realistic thing. And then slowly, the next day, we dip our toes in the supernatural, and then the final, we're in the supernatural. And that's why I kind of think that the telephone kind of works for me in the Italian version. In the American version,
that's a good observation.
But in the American version, what you kind of get is kind of got there, and then the telephone does seem out of place where it is because it's not lulling you into these stories. And where in the Italian version with the telephone at the beginning, it does kind of lull you in. You kind of see this, okay. And then when you get to the next one, it's like, okay, he's just twisted the knife a little bit deeper now. And then the final story, the knife is fully twisted sort of thing. So you kind of like slowly lulling you into is going to get worse and worse and worse. And that's what I quite like the telephone. And I like the simple fact that, you know, we are dealing with a telephone is what, about 20, 30 minutes long? Yeah. And if you consider that 3/4 of it is one woman, that's it, and a voice on the telephone.
Right.
And to be able to carry on that suspense where your mind's not wandering, you're not looking at your mobile phone, and just keep with it and figure out what's going on here.
It was suspenseful.
And be able to do it. And another thing that Mario Bava does, and he does this with all the films as well, and other films, you know, that we, you know, that if you end up liking Mario Bava, you start seeing more and more of his films. He does something that horror directors don't do. He does his horror brightly lit. So you see everything, which is quite a task. Because normally what happens with horror, what you do is you try to hide as much as possible and have things pop out at you that will light up when they pop out at you, like a haunted house show at a sideshow or a fair or something like that. But Bava doesn't do that. He keeps everything very well lit. He makes sure that you're going to see every single imperfection, every single thing, because you're going to get involved. And I also like the way Mario Bava does, you know, in the telephone, and, you know, touch on this more in the next story, is that there is a tormented Disney-esque way if he films things. It's almost like an animated Disney cartoon, but it's like an evil Disney cartoon Technicolor thing going underneath it, which I don't think that Hollywood's ever been able to actually really do very, very well as far as being able to influence, take live action and give it this kind of animated, you know, prime color Technicolor sort of things. Lots of people try it, but I think Mario Bava is probably the only one that, you know, can actually be able to do this successfully. Especially like if you see other films of him, like Blood and Black Lace and things like that, which is very more evident as far as this, the technical cues that he uses.
It's his lighting on the actors, like the females, they're like impeccable.
Yeah.
You know, in the film, I mean, they don't even if they had a hair out of place, you wouldn't notice it because the way he just, you know, zooms in on them. I mean, they're perfect.
Hollywood tends to focus on women or any actor, and it's mostly like, so they're outward beauty, but Mario Bava shows their inner beauty. It's kind of weird. He's able to, you'll find this in all his films, actually. It doesn't matter which one it is, but his film kind of lingers there, and it's like, they're pretty, but then as he lingers his camera on them, especially in the telephone, you start seeing the more inner beauty about it. You know, it's like, there's beauties in their imperfections.
Yes.
And he draws that out. And I don't know many directors who can actually do that. It's either you're beautiful or you're ugly, and there's no in between. But these women are very, very pretty, but, you know, there are imperfections there that we're looking at. But it's the imperfections that make them even more beautiful. And that's right. What Bob does very, very well with his filming technique. And I think in the telephone, you really get to see that, you know, sort of thing.
That's very good.
So I guess this now brings us to the Wordalak. Now, the Wordalak is probably one of the greater vampire shorts that I think we'll see in film. And let's start off with Joe. What's your views of the Wordalak?
The Wordalak to me is the weakest of the three films, but I still absolutely love it. When you see the crumbling architecture and the way that's filmed during the escape sequences, the lighting on Zdenka, again, phenomenal.
So medieval.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing that that again the notes that I made about the I wrote down, just as without Bay of Blood, there's no Friday the 13th, and without Blood and Black Lace, there's no giallo genre. Without Black Sabbath, there's no creep show. You have things in this movie that you later see in Night of the Living Dead and Salem's Lot. Mm. So,
yes, Romero, exactly. Yeah, Salem's Lot. Yes, exactly. I thought it was really disturbing.
Let me in.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Was oh my God, this is Salem's Lot.
Especially the little boy part. That was really disturbing. The little boy knocking on the door, wanting his mother, and being a mom, it's just like, you don't care if your kid's a zombie or a vampire. You want your kid. You're going to open the door. You know, I mean, that it really became, well, it kind of gave you anxiety because you know Boris Karloff comes back. You know he's evil. You know that you kind of know what's going to happen without even reading a short story or without even guessing, because he just comes back and you can tell the family knows he's off, you know? Mm-hmm. So you know it's just going to go downhill rapidly, so.
Well, the howling dog has something to do with it.
Oh, they shot the dog. It's like, don't shoot the dog.
The howling dog, Dark Shadows uses it every time Barnabas appears in Dark Shadows.
Oh, no kidding.
Out comes the howling dog. So obviously Dan Curtis is a fan of this as well.
Possibly, but, yeah. And I didn't even think that put two and two together on that one.
The mother taking the child no matter what, because it's my baby, was also used in Night of the Living Dead in the basement with the little girl that kills her mother with the with
that's
the spade.
That's right.
So it really seems to, and Romero, I think, definitely. Hooper, I don't know, maybe Salem's Lot. The other,
well, I don't know. I mean, if you look at in Salem's Lot, when Danny Glick comes to the window, if you look at the way that's filmed with the Technicolor blue shading that's being used, and when we see the little boy here, there is the same, you know, the Technicolor blue hue that's going on, and the floating thingy, and everything's kind of, when the child is walking through, if you notice, he's walking, he must have slowed the film down slightly when he's filming it. Not, I mean, he actually must have sped up the film slightly. And so therefore you kind of got this floatiness going on, even though it's done in real time.
Definitely.
So maybe Toby Hopper was a fan as well, because there are a lot of similarities, and even in the filming side of it, when it comes to that, because the rest of Salem's Lot's not filmed like that at all. It's just that one sequence.
In Tim Lucas's massive, massive book on Mario Bava's film, it's called All the Colors of the Dark. The introduction to it is written by Martin Scorsese, and Scorsese particularly mentions the Vordalak as a true masterpiece of horror cinema, that segment. So Scorsese's a huge fan. It feels like Romero and Hooper were both big fans. Scorsese mentioned Bava as the filmmaker that filmmakers love. And I think that's evident when you see what's come after this. It's fantastic.
I think what I like about the Vordalak as well is that I think as a kid I kind of got lost in it a little bit. I didn't like that, but seeing it as an adult and seeing it more recently, I realized that there's a lot in it that makes a lot more sense than when I was a kid. When I was a kid, it's like when Boris Karloff, the matriarch of the family, shows up, and you're thinking, why is the family putting up with this? Why are they, you know, they're taking it off. But then looking as an adult, I also look at it from the time period. He is the, you know, the patriarch of the family, he's their father. And the thing is, you know, your father's there to protect you, and he said that he's protect you, and he's come in, and, you know, and you got to remember that fathers normally are not your talk, you know, especially in, you know, European, and you see in England especially. The dad here is not like the American TV dad. What you have is someone who's quite stoic, very, doesn't show a lot of emotions, is kind of like there to protect the family. And he kind of comes in and is a man of very few words, unless your mom tells you that you've done something and he needs to have a go at you, then daddy is all words. But normally daddy just comes in and he does do this. And I noticed that the family dynamics, it works very, very well with the Vordalak when I was watching this time around. And all of it does make sense. You know,
well, like the anxiety of the mother when he picks up the grandson, he goes, aren't I allowed to touch my own grandson? You know, and it's like, you know, he's evil. A little kid's innocent, doesn't know. I mean, through a pair of older eyes, it makes more sense now.
But another thing is, you have to remember that if you got a family where everyone's living together, and this is including the married partners as well, you know, and you do get this in, you know, in ethnic minorities, basically what happens is that, you know, you have, you know, mother and father, and then the children get married and they live at home and stuff like this. And, you know, and stuff like this. And the father does hold, you know, the patriotic, you know, father or the older mother, you know, they still hold the household. And then, you know, then the families underneath them, they, you know, they monitor their own families, but you still have this one overseeing. It's kind of like,
right.
you know, a bit like the royal family, I guess, sort of thing, I guess is how you would look at that. And I think that's where this works out very, very well. I think once you understand their family structure, it all makes sense. And I thought that was very, very well. I did see a bit of a documentary on the making of this, and I found it quite interesting that Boris Karloff went over there and learned Italian, which, and Mark Damon did too. They learned all their lines in Italian, and they spoke their lines in Italian, which is quite a feat if you think of the simple fact that normally what was happening in Italian is that they would hire people from all over different countries in Europe. And then what they would do is they would all speak their own language while doing their lines. And then they would dub them afterwards. But Mark Damon on a really good documentary about the making of this film was talking about that. Now him and Boris went off and they figured out they were working together. So on the plane, they went through and sat with the Italian stewardess who was teaching him how to do all their lines for them.
Fantastic. Oh, interesting fact.
So I was like, well, that's impressive. So
I interviewed Steve Reeves, who made his mark playing Hercules in Italian movies. And right. He said exactly what you said, Keith. He said that there was a scene in a movie called The White Warrior where we're sitting around a campfire and all the chieftains of the tribes are gathering to discuss what to do next. He said everybody was speaking in their language. And he said, so I would have to wait for certain vocal cues to go into my lines, which I was speaking in English. Mm. And he said, but nobody understood anything that anybody was saying. He said, I never understood a thing that the director was telling me, not a thing. He said, so I just went in there and got the money and did the job. I wanted to ask about the Vertilac, and I can't remember if that's something I read about or was it implicit in the movie that the vampire must kill his family?
They go for their own family in the beginning. Apparently that's what it was in this movie, or at least by what I was reading.
Yeah,
they go back after their family members first.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, though, because, I mean, to be honest, if you're going to, you know, if you come in and your family trusts you, first of all, they'll be the easiest prey. And then when they do change, they're going to be the ones that are going to be more dedicated to you. They're going to be your dedicated soldiers more than.
So there's no explanation as to how Boris's character becomes a Vertilac, except the idea that he went after this man.
He went after a Vertilac. He killed him and cut his head off and he brought it back. Is that not how it went?
Yeah, and he was wounded by the Vertilac, presumably bitten and infected.
Bitten? Okay, that's what I thought.
I presume bitten. He's got the wound on his chest.
And wasn't it interesting to see Boris as a villain? I mean, at that point, we hadn't seen him as a monster in quite a long time. So for him to be playing this monstrous character, he was quite effective.
I've got the definition of what Vertilac. It says it's a vampire in Slavic folklore, and some Western sources define it as a type of Russian vampire that must consume the blood of its loved ones and convert its whole family.
There you go.
Which also makes sense because Lamberto Bava, Mario Bava's son, says that Mario was very heavily into Russian literature. And one of the things he was proudest of is that he apparently had read everything by Dostoevsky half a dozen times. So it makes absolute sense that he would know Russian folklore and Slavic folklore. So yeah, that's wonderful. Wonderful to hear that.
It was very scary. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
This whole movie scared the shit out of me when I was a little
kid. Once they took off on horseback, it wasn't as interesting at the end. You know, when they were escaping on horseback and all that, that didn't interest me. But it had such a dismal ending.
What was the thing about the stuffed horse at the end, Rod? Did you read something about that? A stuffed horse. He was sitting at a... Something about the end.
Wait a minute. I can't remember where...
You're talking about the epilogue, aren't you?
I'm not sure.
Isn't there a scene filmed where Boris is supposedly on a horse? And all these branches, he's riding past all these branches, and the camera pulls back.
That's the epilogue credit sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so they did it as a joke at the end. Oh, that's kind of neat.
In the Italian version, yes. I don't think they show that in the English version.
I didn't see it. I couldn't find it either.
I have seen it. I have seen it, but I don't remember seeing the Italian version. But I did see that.
That's why I was asking, and I didn't see it in either version.
It's in the Italian version.
I'll have to fast forward.
It's the way
now.
The film closes, and it's Boris Karloff wishing you a good night and have a good evening. And
I'm going to have to fast forward.
And then it looks like he's on a horse, and then basically what happens is Mario Bava does this thing that. Films like The Player and other films in Hollywood do basically pull back, and then you see the camera crew and the special effects people working everything as the camera's pulling back to make you realize. And it's quite interesting because it's especially after the next film that we do, The Drop of Water, it's kind of reminding the audience that before you go home, just remember, no matter how scared you are, you've just seen a film. And I thought that was very, very clever.
Yeah. I wish I would have known about that when I was 7 or 8 years old, because The Drop of Water scared the shit out of me.
Oh, yeah.
At 7 or 8 years old, you wouldn't have seen it because it wasn't in our version.
Yeah.
That's true.
How old was Boris then?
Oh, God.
Film was 1963. He did a lot more films after this, because he was working with Roger Corman after this, wasn't he?
Right.
He did The Raven.
Tales of Terror.
Comedy of Terror.
Yeah.
He passed away in 1968 or 69, I think. So this was towards the end of his life. He must have been in his 60s or 70s at this point.
Yeah.
He was also on The Girl from U.N.C.L.E., which was an obscure show with Stephanie Powers. And he played a woman called Mother Muffin, the Mother Muffin Affair. And that was after Black Sabbath.
I mean, there's one thing that I wish Boris Karloff did, which he didn't do, but he did on stage, was Arsenic and Old Lace. And I kind of wish he was in the movie of that, actually.
Yes. I think he was supposed to be.
He was supposed to be, and there was a reason why he couldn't. Wasn't he committed
to
the play? Maybe he was
typesetting at the studio or something. He did it on Broadway.
February 69.
The movie was not released right away because the play was still going on Broadway. I think that's what it was. They waited until the movie, the show was done, and he was committed to the Broadway performance. Because was Josephine Hall and those people, were they in the Broadway show?
I think the two aunts and the one who played Teddy comes from the Broadway production. But then
the guy
again,
Teddy, I've seen him in many films.
Yeah,
and Cary Grant
wasn't. TV movie.
No, he was over the top. I didn't like that performance from him. He was just too broad. You know, although I like Cary Grant, but I didn't like that performance by him.
But Peter Lorre was good in it. So.
I kind of liked it, and I thought it was funny.
It's a Halloween movie. I mean, it takes place on Halloween night, so.
I thought it was
It's the whole thing that you're kind of watching the Arsenic and Old Lace, and they go, oh, you look like that actor, and then, you know, they're talking about Boris Karloff, but it would have been nice if it was Boris Karloff, like he got in the Broadway production. So
right.
Well, didn't Bela Lugosi do a stage production of that? Do they say you look like Bela? He says I look like Bela Lugosi, or is it Boris Karloff? Did they change the line?
I don't know. I mean, I know that Boris did on Broadway, and the playwright wrote it for Boris, but they might have changed it for Bela when he took over.
It gets a big laugh.
Yeah,
it gets a big laugh.
But when you see the movie, it's kind of like you have to go, who are they talking about? You're kind of doing that slightly thing. And then after a while, you kind of catch on, but you kind of have to know.
Well, I think they actually name-dropped Karloff in the movie.
Yeah, eventually. After they say about two or three times, because you have the town cop coming in, and he goes, yo, you look like such and such. And someone else says it. And finally, about the third or fourth time, they go, you look like, and then they say Karloff's name, sort of thing.
I find it interesting. I know a high school girl recently that did a stage production of Arsenic and Old Lace, and they left the Karloff line intact, and none of them knew who Karloff is. I'm like, why wouldn't you update that and use
somebody Kruger.
Use somebody who's like a modern horror star, you know? Why not do that?
Isn't that sad? Yeah. They're doing Arsenic and Old Lace, but they don't know who Boris Karloff is. There's something strange about that, but it's sad, too.
It's a different thing. Like, I learned about all these movies from watching late-night TV, and they would come on, or I'd be watching this, watching on Cinemax. The first time I saw Black Sabbath was the American version on Cinemax, and I wasn't that thrilled with it. I didn't think it was that good. Later on, the DVD came out, and it was Italian, and it was in Italian, and I watched it with my parents, who only spoke Italian, and I I just saw this completely different movie, and I wasn't sure if it was just me, but
my mom's Italian too. She grew up in an Italian speaking household. My grandfather lived with us when this was on too. So they caught on more to it than I did because I was little, but my mom used to love watching this stuff. It scared the shit out of me when I was a kid.
We lived in a time and a generation where we would catch things on TV as they came on that we normally wouldn't seek out. Nowadays, specifically looking for Boris Karloff. If you're 17, 18 years old, you don't know who the fuck Boris Karloff is because you're not looking for him.
I know. Isn't that especially a shame? It's a real shame because there's so much out there that they can now see.
But I think it's like that with any kind of, like, you know, it's a bit like I remember going to Tower Records or HMV and I would go through and like look for new music. And you go through and it's like, and then you would find stuff that you probably would never hear before. And I would buy that and take that home. Now with Amazon, you kind of need to know what you're looking for. And that's the problem. Another thing is that we did have, you know, because a lot of these films were cheap to show, you know, outside of where Vicky and I grew up, Syracuse, NBC, Channel
Monster
3.
Monster Movie Matinee.
They did Monster Movie Matinee, and every Saturday they would show one of these horror films. And of course, you had the horror host, which, by the way,
guy with the patch on his eye. What was his name?
And the one with the hand, sort of thing.
Patchy.
And the interesting thing is every city across America had their own little horror host. And if you want to know more about this, I suggest that you seek out the documentary on Amazon about these horror hosts, which is quite interesting. And they gave, you know, I remember I used to spend weekends with my grandmother. My grandmother and I, at 1 o'clock every Saturday, would sit there and watch these horror films. And then Channel 5 did a, which was a CBS, and it's out of Syracuse. On a Sunday, would do a thing called EVOM. It goes, EVOM, like this, and they would show another film. And we thought, oh my God, EVOM, it's so scary. Well, EVOM is movie spelled backwards, but hey, that's what you learn when you get older. They would show these, you know, killer but they would, theater. They wouldn't show like the old 30s, 40s, 50s or 60s. They would do like these 60s and 70s films.
And, children shouldn't play with dead things. That was on during the day on Channel 3 or coming out of Syracuse. Chiller Theater used to play it too. Remember the hand coming out of the mud?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that movie, I had to rewatch that actually about a week ago because I was like, oh my God, my mother let me watch that and she wouldn't let me watch Dark Shadows. It's like, what the hell?
You guys are all young. You guys are all youngsters. Oh my God. I saw these at the movies. Come on.
Well, the thing is,
you're not that much older than us.
But I think today is because everything is
way older.
But I think today we don't really have any of that stuff. I know that Jim Bob at the drive-in, Joe Bob, sorry, at the drive-in. I know that he's, as far as 80s and 90s stuff goes, he's very good at helping you rediscover that.
But I like his older stuff too. Someone had a watch party with him the other day ago when he was his younger self doing the 80s movies and stuff. Those are such a hoot still. And he hasn't changed.
He was my introduction to a lot of movies too, because I'd be clicking through on Saturday night and all of a sudden I'd be watching like this old horror movie.
Fans.
And I'm like, wait a minute, what COVID? Is this?
I thought he had COVID-19.
Yes, it actually happened
February.
He got it early on. He caught it while everyone came after him on Twitter over a piece he wrote last year.
Yeah.
So he wasn't very responsive during all that, and everyone's like, oh, he's not responding.
They wanted him to talk about it, and he just goes, everybody wear a damn mask and get over it so we can get our lives back. He didn't want all this. He just didn't want any – he wanted these people to focus on the show and not – the illness, because people want to escape all this crap in reality by watching his show. So that's what he was focusing on. But I guess Darcy kind of jumped onto him and said, "No, you got to share your experience about what happened."
He was
part of the 84% of people who got COVID were mild anyway. So, you know, he wasn't part of the death curse COVID. You know, the 13.6%.
Can we just all need to agree?
Or the 0.08 who are actually tragic, the ones who die.
I don't want to see anybody die. I don't like seeing anybody.
No, but I'm sitting there saying, like, so I mean, the thing is, if you just get regular COVID, most people do pull through it. So, I mean, he's probably not going to have it's very rare that people do go on the respirators. And that I mean, that's probably, and he wasn't on the respirator, so that's the story you want to tell. The one is, yeah, like, exactly. I was sick in 2 weeks on my sofa is not a really exciting story. So I imagine he's probably thinking, why do I need to share this? Okay, I had the flu for 2 weeks.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there were people like Joel Reed who got it and ended up passing away. So there's...
Precisely, you know, I'm saying that's more of a more interesting story than someone being sick with the flu. That's, you know, what I'm saying is kind of like,
I mean, I'm with everyone else. We, if we're going to get through this, we're going to have to get through it together. Just do what you got to do to try to avoid catching it and avoid spreading it.
Sure. But of course.
Thankfully, he's still with us.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yes.
But
devastated.
Joe Bob.
But I can understand why he probably didn't want to say too much about it. Cause you know, from what I've read, he had the mild case and that'd be sitting at home for 2 weeks. Feeling rough. That's from what he was saying. So,
but as far as Joe Bob goes, like I said, he was my introduction to a lot of this stuff. So he was a major part of why I love horror movies so much. That and the video store box art.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. You grew up on the video store.
No, go ahead, Rod.
Well, I was just going to say, if you're of the generation who grew up on video stores, you had a lot of education there. I mean, those boxes were so graphic. Yeah, I remember I was talking to somebody who had seen Pet Sematary on video, and became obsessed with this movie over the years. Ended up doing a documentary. Yeah, Pet Sematary, Stephen King's Pet Sematary.
Which one?
And
the old one. I'm assuming the old one.
That'd be the 89.
The old one with Fred Gwynn in it.
Right.
Yes, with Fred Gwynn of the Munsters. And that movie, they tracked me down because I had been the correspondent for Fangoria magazine on that set, and I went to the movie set and watched it.
Right.
And for him to tell me that he started watching this when he was 7 or 8 years old from a video store. And I was already 30 years old at that time when I went to the movie set. It was like it was a sobering moment for me. But he explained to me how they learned about all these movies through videos. And I didn't even realize that, but that is true. So that happened to you, Joe?
For me, it was The Monster Club, the Vincent Price, John Carradine film from...
That was a cable staple for a while, wasn't it? Like on Movie Channel or something like in the early 80s?
I actually got it because I was like obsessed with the front cover, which was the original British movie poster, which had all these colorful monster faces on it. My parents said I would rent it constantly when I was like 5, 6 years old. I wanted it, and they had to watch it and make sure that there was nothing in it. And Elvira on the side of it presenting the poster, which I guess speaks volumes about what everything in my life now, monster faces and gorgeous goth women. But that was the one that I got obsessed with. It's not even that good a movie, but I love it.
Is that
this
the one
day.
Where there's like a band? Is there like a band of monsters that plays music in a club?
UB40 is one of the bands. It's Vincent Price is a vampire who bites the novelist R. Chetwynd Hayes, who's played by John Carradine. And he tells him, you know, we didn't bite that deep. You're not going to become one of us. I just needed a meal. And then he, realizing who he is, takes him to this club where all the monsters gather. And he tells them all these stories about all these monsters that are lesser known. And it's super cool.
A Whistler? Whistler?
The Shadmock. The Whistler.
I do remember. I have seen this. Right, I have seen that.
I love this one so much that when my first screenplay was optioned, I bought the original UK poster for it and had it framed. And I bought an Australian poster that's actually the monster genealogy chart that Vincent Price and John Carradine are sitting by.
Oh, my word.
So I was obsessed with that movie. And it's not even that good.
That's awesome, though.
But it's just everything about that movie just kind of, like, the box art drew me in and made me a lifelong fan.
That's a childhood thing. I think that's wonderful. That's what makes fans.
It was an 80s film, isn't it?
Yeah, like 80, 81.
Oh, definitely.
Early
80s. Because in that documentary, In the Darkness on Shudder, that 4.5 hour, about 80
film. That was an excellent
They do mention that film and what everything like that. And the reason why it flopped wasn't because of the people who saw the movie loved it, but they had, because of some of the violence, it was rated PG-13.
Yeah.
So
at that point,
that was an excellent 4-hour documentary.
That's Amicus, right?
Excellent.
That's Amicus that did that.
It wasn't Amicus. Club. It was after Milton. It was Milton Subotsky from Amicus after he broke away from Amicus. Hmm. I think it was like ITV.
I see. Something like that.
I love that I'm actually talking about Amicus with somebody, by the way, because nobody ever talks about them.
I saw Dr. Terror's House of Horrors at the movie theater when I was a kid.
Another one.
And the only episode I can remember with any clarity is something about a vine, some kind of evil vine that was crawling up the walls of a house. That's the only thing I can remember. And Donald Sutherland was in that before Donald Sutherland became famous. Just like in Die, Die, My Darling, he's in there too, and he plays a big part.
Yep.
Well, I also remember Tales of the Crypt as them as well, wasn't it, with Joan Collins and the Santa Claus?
Yeah, that was later, though. That was in 72. Yeah. But
Asylum is another Amicus anthology.
I love Asylum. I love Tales from the Crypt.
Asylum's great. Yeah,
the torture garden.
Where's the one where they're in an elevator? They're all kind of go down an elevator, and they're in kind of this room. And then
that's Tales from the Crypt?
That's Tales from the Crypt. Okay. Oh, we know that's Vault
they
of Horror.
They open up into hell.
Vault of Horror.
Vault of Horror was edited. They left some parts out of it, the Vault of Horror.
Vault of Horror was the one with the elevator, though. That's the sequel to Tales from the Crypt.
And then there's the House of Drip Blood as well. Isn't that them as well?
The House of Drip Blood. It's another one, yeah. Which
yes, the House of you said Asylum, right? Yeah, that's
Asylum.
Because in the UK, they did an Amicus box set, which was like 20 of their films, and it's all in a shape of a coffin.
So actually, my favorite one was from Beyond the Grave.
Yeah, wait, it's from Beyond the Grave. Wait, it's funny you should mention that. Is that the one where some man is being haunted by a poltergeist and he calls a medium, a woman in there, and it starts tearing the house apart while they're in there? Is that it?
Yes, that's one of the stories in from Beyond the Grave.
And somebody opens up a door and it leads to another dimension or another age.
Yeah,
or whatever.
I think that's Ian Ogilvy from The Conqueror Worm. I think that's who.
Yeah,
I think
And I can't remember who the woman was, but she was well known too. The woman who was his wife, and it had something to do with a door. I remember that, and it was like a conquistador or something that was in there.
Yeah, they open the door, and it goes back in history to like this. Yeah, there was the mirror one too, with David Warner.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that one. That's about murder, right?
Yeah,
murdering.
He needs to feed the mirror. Yeah.
That reminds me of Dead of Night. Have you seen Dead of Night? That was like the first omnibus film.
The 40s one. Yeah, I was going to say there's three Dead of Nights.
Which also has a haunted mirror in it, a haunted mirror sequence, which is quite good.
But then it has that really weird golfer story in it as well, doesn't it? In the Dead of Night.
Yeah, that's the one. Actually, they cut that out of some prints because it just doesn't fit. It's too comedy. It's comedic. Mm-hmm. But the one about the ventriloquist dummy is quite good too.
Yeah, that's with
Michael Redgrave.
Lynn Redgrave's dad, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Lynn and Vanessa's dad.
Branching out into all these anthology films now.
It happens every time. Every time.
I think this is our cue to get back to Black Sabbath, and we're going to start with Drop of Water.
The film everyone wants to hear us talk about.
What about
so, Rod,
Garden?
Tell us about what your thoughts of The Drop of Water.
I thought that was high-octane horror. High-octane horror. Now, when I saw that, it scared me shitless. There's no other way to describe it. It's the kind of thing that when you go to bed at night, it plays behind your eyelids, and you see this all coming back to you. That when you turn around, that woman that's dead is going to be lying in the bed right next to you with that grimace of her face. It's funny because for all the times that I've seen that movie, I always thought that was a dummy. Because definitely at the end, at one point, you see it rolling across the floor and the arms slowly come up like it's a mannequin. But I saw a production photograph.
She was levitating.
Well, no, she was actually walking, but she was rolling kind of.
I don't care. It was scary.
I saw a production a photograph of her in bed when she is dead, and they were putting a mask on someone. So that was actually a real person.
Yeah
it was.
But I thought it was.
A wax mask created by Eugenio Bava, Mario's father.
Well, it was a masterpiece. That mask was so scary. So it was a real person wearing it then?
Yeah, yeah, it was a real person wearing it, and they put her on like some kind of dolly and rolled her in the end where she's coming at, I forget the character's name, the thief of the ring.
Yeah, the nurse.
Helen Chester.
The nurse who chokes herself.
This movie stayed with me up until today. When I watched it when I was a kid, it scared the bejesus out of me. And when I started watching Black Sabbath again after I don't know how many decades I had not seen it, I go, oh my God, it's this movie that scared the living shit out of me when I was a little kid. And I always remembered and the choking thing. And oh my God, that one of the best horror shorts I've ever seen.
Everyone said that.
Well, there was so many neat little things. Like when she went to the house, there were these dolls everywhere, just thrown about, baby dolls and things like that. And the old lady who's there, she brings her into the kitchen and says that she fixed her dress. And the light slowly descends, and she kept pushing it up. And they don't make any remark about it. It just happens. I don't know if that happens in the Italian version as well.
It does.
But it does, and they don't make any remark about it. It's just that the light comes down, then it goes back up. She steals the ring, and when she goes back to her apartment, which she had left earlier, and it was a nice, cozy affair, now there's has a whole different kind of feel about it. There's the lighting, for one thing. Of course, the lights end up going out. But the water that she can hear dripping that's not really dripping, the fly. I mean, it was just so weirdly done. You know something. She's going to pay for her sin, whatever it is. You know, the fact that she stole this.
Who steals
this
in their
diamond.
Right mind from the dead, especially a creepy-looking medium woman who's dead that looks like... I would never take anything off some corpse that looked like that. That is for sure.
Well, they do say that she had some connection to the dead. I mean, didn't she die in the course of some kind of spell? Wasn't it something like that?
Something like that.
That was a psychic. And now I got to look that up. That's going to drive me nuts.
When Helen shows up, the servant woman tells her, she asks her, why me? Why couldn't you get some family or friends to come
right,
do this?
Right.
And she says, the only friends she had were the ones that helped shake the table, implying that she had a connection to the dead. So why would you steal that ring? Why would you steal from somebody who clearly has a connection to the dead? And
that's also though, I guess if you're in the medical, I mean, I know that in the medical profession, when I do see dead bodies on a regular occasion, you kind of just, you don't look at them as people. So I kind of took it that maybe that was her reason. It's like, okay, she shouldn't steal from it, but it's kind of like the person's dead and, you know, sort of thing. And a nurse or someone in medical's more in science or not about physical sort of thing, maybe. So
I don't get the impression that she's a nurse. I get the impression that she's just a woman for hire for whatever small task you have.
Okay.
Which is usually dressing a corpse. I mean, she's obviously somebody who dresses a corpse after they die.
Clearly,
you know, I mean,
she's done
this
more than once, probably.
Oh, yeah, she's definitely
done. Yeah, that's what I thought. But usually they wash the body and they do all kinds of stuff, you know. I can't remember if they show her washing the body. I don't think they do they?
No.
Or do they?
They don't show it.
No. They show her dressing and putting her shoes on.
It's more the implying sort of thing.
But let me ask you this. Her crime, which is stealing the ring, is that enough to die for?
Depends on
does the punishment, is it over the top as far as what she should have been punished? I mean, frightening her to death would be one thing. Frightening her, not to death, but just frightening her. But killing her over a ring, and of course we all know the other lady.
I'd probably kill someone if they stole my mobile phone.
But is it
that would lose something, though.
Is it the ghost that's killing the people, or is it the ring? And this is something that Tim Lucas also brings up, is David Lynch seems to have been inspired by this with Twin Peaks. Annie takes the ring in Twin Peaks, and it marks her for death. And then while she's in the hospital, in one of the deleted scenes from Fire Walk With Me, it's implied that a nurse steals the ring from Annie, and that marks her for death. So that's... Is that the implication that it's the ring that's actually cursed?
Well, I mean, the sapphire is a wisdom stone. Mm-hmm. So the sapphire is known to restore balance with the body and its spirit.
Well, let's say she never took the ring. If she never took the ring, would she still be haunted when she went back to her room?
I don't believe so.
Would nothing happen? It would just be nothing, right?
I think it would be nothing because, to be honest, I think it's because it's a sapphire ring, because the sapphire it aligns the body with the physical, mental, and spiritual planes, bringing serenity and peace of mind, so the body can pass into the next world.
Oh, really?
That's what a sapphire does in supernatural terms.
Right.
Isn't the Hope Diamond also a sapphire?
Well, that's the meaning behind it. So, and I think that's why it's a sapphire ring in this instance. Because if the woman steals that, then obviously she's not going to be able to pass over, is she? Maybe.
Maybe that's it.
Already passed over?
Well, she was a psychic too. Wasn't she a dabbler of sorts?
A medium, you know, or a psychic or something.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Let me throw this out to you guys. The ring seems to be a very important plot device, but the name of the show is A Drop of Water. And there seems to be a fly that plays a big part in this. What do they have to do with it? What does a drop of water have to do with anything?
When she pulls the ring off, she drops it on the ground. As she's going to claim the ring, a glass of water gets spilled, and it starts falling into a plate or a bedpan or something. You just hear the drip, drip, drip.
Right.
And that follows her. So that's why I think had she not taken the ring, none of this would have happened, because I feel like the dripping sound is like the telltale heart. It's there to remind you of your crime.
How much of this actually happened, and how much of it's only in her mind as well?
Also true. It could be guilt.
Because if you ever notice, if you ever notice that with what the whole thing about this thing is, which is all about what happens when you're sat there in your own thoughts with nothing but silence. And that's what a drop of water is. It's all silent. It's everyone just, you're just stuck in a dark room with your own thoughts, nothing else. There's no there's no traffic sound going on in the background. There's no music playing. There's nothing. It's just you and your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But this woman from upstairs came down and stole the ring again. Now, I don't know why this ring is so attractive that everybody's stealing it from dead people.
Money, isn't it? If it's a real sapphire, I mean, in 1910, it probably set you up for life for a while,
money.
Wouldn't it?
It's worth money. But she had to put the hands back on the neck afterward, after extracting the ring.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
You can tell she has to fight to get the ring off the dead woman's hand. So,
none of them ever like take it off smoothly.
I know. She's just like, and that's what you see at the end of the movie. She's got the only thing that you see is where the ring has been taken off her finger. So obviously she came back to get a ring.
Well, the body does die, I mean, with rigor mortis, that's the reason why you don't put shoes on a person in a coffin.
I want shoes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you're doing barefoot because you can't get the shoes.
Well, they cut the clothes and put them around you. They don't like dress you, you know.
But they do that in the Sears catalogs as well. That's how they do it. That's the reason why clothes always look really good in catalogs, because they slice them at the back and they paperclip them in the back to give you the right shape. So then when you buy clothes and you bring them home and it's like, this doesn't fit me right. That's the reason why.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. What about the people that make the corpses up and do the hair and all that stuff? Somebody's got to do that stuff.
I know a couple of people who do that for a living, actually.
I do too.
So they do the makeup and hair on the simple ones, but they also have to do reconstructive on the ones who might have not died in the most pleasant of ways. So they have to build it up with clay and everything like that. It's quite interesting what they tell you about.
It is.
So
build it up with clay. Oh God, I don't want to die.
Yeah, it's basically to put it like something happened. You get in a car accident and your face gets slubbed into the back of your skull, and they need to redo your skull. If a family wants an open casket after something like that, then what they can do is they can hire. It cost them extra, but they would have to reconstruct the face from.
Yeah, it's an art, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an art.
Yes, I've had a.
One other
career.
One other film illusion or film that was definitely inspired by this, if anybody has seen Dead Silence by James Wan.
Oh, yes.
I feel like this is a definite I feel like Wan definitely based that on this from The Old Woman with All the Dolls. That and Kill Baby Kill. It was based on this, and it was based on Baba's Kill Baby Kill, I feel. I feel like Dead Silence was heavily inspired by this as well. So we got Twin Peaks and Dead Silence on this one. If we were to just talk about the movies Baba inspired, we'd be here all day.
And what happened to that actress? What did she ever go on and do? The one who played the nurse?
Well, Jacqueline Perrieu.
Yeah, whatever happened to her?
You could have a big career in France. I don't know if she's French, but she's got a French name.
I just watched Tenebrae yesterday by Dario Argento. That was pretty good. I had never seen that film before.
You got with Piper Laurie.
Tony Franciosa was in that, and John Saxon was the two Americans in them. It was like a Stephen King-ish. It was like Stephen King going on a murder spree, basically. It was very good.
Saxon died a couple weeks ago, didn't he?
Yes, Saxon just died recently. I think it might have even just been a couple weeks.
Yeah. So.
Turner Classic Movies had a in memoriam for Olivia de Havilland literally a day after she died. So they must have had this in the vault for a while.
When you're 101 years old.
I know. She was 104, actually.
104?
Yeah, 104. 2016, she was 100. So
yeah.
She just had her birthday. She was a great actress.
I wonder if she's beating the shit out of her sister in heaven right now.
Probably. I wouldn't be at all surprised.
And Hitchcock's let's film them together. So
yes.
So I think what we'll do now is let's talk about our overall thoughts about Black Sabbath. So, Vicky, what are your overall thoughts of Black Sabbath?
This has got to be like one of my favorite horror movies, actually, because very few, even like the modern stuff, it's just like, it doesn't scare me. Not gross enough. Doesn't scare me. But this isn't even really gross, but I mean, you know, just the directing and the filming and just how it's all approached scared the bejesus out of me. And when I watched this, like I remember, like I said, it was several decades later, I revisited this movie and it still scared the shit out of me. It's a great movie. They don't make them like this anymore. That's the only thing I can say. And the best thing about talking to y'all, because there's a lot of stuff about this I don't know until I talk to you guys, which is always a learning experience, and I always appreciate that. But it's a great movie. If you really love horror and you like the old stuff and you like the new stuff or anything, it's a must-see for anybody out there that likes scary stuff. Definitely. It's in the top 10 for me anyway. Maybe even the top 5.
What about yourself, Rod? What are your final thoughts?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I think it's a classic. No violence to be shown. You don't see any violence. You don't see any blood. And you don't see people being stabbed to death. You don't see anything like that. It's all atmosphere revved up to the nth degree, and they deliver. And it's the kind of thing that haunts your dreams. It really is a haunting kind of spell that Baba has created. And that seems to be his style, I thought. And definitely, in my opinion, The Verdillac and A Drop of Water are masterpieces and much scarier than anything that I've seen on, you know, anthology TV growing up, like Twilight Zone or even Thriller that was hosted by Karloff, yes. Although there were some good ones on Thriller, some very good ones.
I love some of those.
So I would recommend... Oh, yeah, those are great. I would highly recommend this, highly recommend it to any horror buff, even people who don't know who Boris Karloff is. You don't need to know. You don't need to know who he is. Mm. He's an old man introducing this movie. That's all.
And what about yourself, Joe? What are your final thoughts?
Absolutely a masterpiece. I think it's the most influential horror movie ever made because without it, yes. Some of the greatest filmmakers we know even pay homage to it. So one of the most influential, maybe the most influential, it elevates the genre to art because just the way everything's lit, the way everything's shot, the set design, the cinematography, the tension in all the scenes, how terrifying. Like, anybody I know that saw this movie, like Vicky said, you remember the drop of water. You remember the face of that woman.
You remember that one, for sure.
It's iconic. It's an iconic movie. I think it's one of the most important films in the genre. I don't think it gets enough credit outside of people who, like, really know movies or know cinema. I think it's absolutely a must-watch for anybody who loves horror movies, because it's without it, there's so many movies that do not exist. And without Mario Bava, actually, a couple days ago, a friend of mine in Virginia who teaches film studies said he's doing a horror films class, and he asked, who would you suggest that the students looked into? And I said, Bava, absolutely, because without him, Planet of the Vampires, without that existing, you don't have Alien. Without Bay of Blood, you don't have Friday the 13th. Without Blood and Black Lace, you don't have the slasher genre. So he is, just in particular, Mario Bava, I think, is the most important filmmaker in the history of the genre.
The pioneer, for sure.
Definitely. He's the bridge. He's the bridge to from the old 1930s and 40s films to modern horror.
Great.
And my thoughts on Black Sabbath, I think it's probably one of the most beautiful looking horror films I've seen.
It is. It really is.
And I also say it's probably got one of the best sound designs of any horror film that's ever been.
Yes.
You know, anything. Sorry?
We didn't even get into that. And it's fantastic, the sound design on it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Considering this was all like mono, you know, mono, and be honest, it's like even the drop of water feels like it's going around the room sort of thing. Even when I, you know, and there's only a mono cut of this film. There's they haven't done a stereo CD or DVD or a stereo Blu-ray of this film. It's still in the same Italian mono that it was released in. And I also have to sit there and say that I think that if you are, you know, if you like films that, you know, if you're in the horror genre, I think you're going to really enjoy this. I also think, though, that if you're into the genetics of filmmaking as a whole, and about the best ways to do this and how to do these in three distinct different ways, and what kind of ways you can achieve this in three separate stories, this is probably a good little introduction about, you know, the wonders of filmmaking and how it can be done. You have three very distinct films, filmed three very different ways, but for some reason, the three very same films actually come together. They're actually part of one whole picture. And there's like, I guess it's like a George Seurat picture for me. George Seurat, if you don't know, is, you know, he does pictures with dots. And basically, if you go up front, there's a bunch of dots. But when you pull back, you see the whole picture. And that's what Mario Bava's Black Sabbath is for me. It's like each story is like this little dot. But then when you pull back, it makes a complete picture. And I think that's the marvel. I don't think that as far as anthology films, I don't think that many anthology films have been able to make something as strong as this. I think that, you know, there's a lot of good anthology films out there, a lot of good horror anthology films. But to have three distinct stories with three basically different ways of filming and three specific ways of coloring and style, I think Mario Bava pulls it out of the hat that I don't think that a lot of other anthologies are able to do. Normally what you get with an anthology, you tend to get, they all film the same. They film the same style, same, you know. And this one, you know, he's like, I'm going to give you three separate stories and they're going to be filmed three separate ways and they're going to be three exactly different stories from each other, but they are going to work together. And he achieves that. So.
You mentioned art. I feel it's like a Hopper painting. Hmm. You know, like his Dorian Gray portrait, you know, it's.
Yeah.
Oh no, that wasn't Hopper. That was, shoot. Now I just made myself look like an ass because now I screwed it up. I can't now the name escapes me of who did the fantastic Dorian Gray painting that I just saw at the Art Institute a couple months back. So, well, I just made myself look like an ass, so I'm going to stop.
You mean the one from the classic film?
You're a fountain of information. I love it.
Yeah, but is this the classic MGM film from the 40s? Is
Dorian
Gray.
Is that
where the painting comes from?
I don't know if it was from
painting you're talking about. Does that still exist? I think I saw something just about that recently. I think it is the same picture.
It's in the Art Institute in Chicago. I saw it recently.
Yeah, the picture that they used in Dorian Gray, the 40s film, is still available. Well, it's out there. I mean, it might be the Chicago Institute, but I know.
Have you seen that film? That's a great film.
The Angela Lansbury film?
Yes.
Yeah, Dorian Gray.
Yes, I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I met her at Hatfield when I was at a local summer stock theater when I was about 15. And we went to it, and all I could ask him about was his Wild Wild West episode, which is very similar to The Portrait of Dorian Gray. I didn't even know he was in that movie. You kick yourself years later.
Well, we'll actually be covering the picture of Dorian Gray in season 4, coming in a couple months.
Oh, I'd like to be involved in that. That's a quality film right from beginning to end.
No, Rod.
I'll send you the dates on those. So that brings us to the end of the Literary License Podcast and the end of our European Horror segment for season 3. This was the end of season 3. We'll be going to season 4. And unfortunately, European Horror is now being transferred to Bewitched, the TV series, which we'll spring that off in 2 weeks with The Passionate Bride and the film I Married a Witch. Next week we'll be doing Dark Shadows episode 353 to 377, where we're going to find out Barnabas's origin stories, and we'll be going back in time to 1795. So, of course, make sure you like, share our episodes, tell your friends, and make sure that you sign up to our newsletter at www.llpodcast.com, and you can get a season 4 t-shirt that will be premiering in October 1st. And so at the moment, let's say goodnight to our guests. So goodnight, Vicky.
Goodnight, everybody.
Goodnight, Joe. Night.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for having me on again. Thank you very much.
You're always welcome on, Joe.
Thank you.
And goodnight, Rod.
Good night, and I'm glad to meet you, Joe.
Glad to meet you, too. Let's actually link up on Facebook and stuff so we can actually communicate, because I love a lot of the films that you're writing about.
Oh, God, you guys will be probably messaging each other till you're both old and gray.
I am old and gray. What are you talking
This has been a Literary License Podcast production, and this was my will.